This is a production of Cornell University.
My name is Nikki Chopra.
And I'm Nishant Trivedi.
And we are co-chairs of the Sick in America series. We'd like to welcome you to tonight's event. It is not only the kickoff of the Sick in America series, but it is also the first ever presidential lecture series on current affairs. We've been working with a board of 15 enthusiastic students for about 6 months planning this week's events. And we're thrilled that you could come to our first one. This series could not have been possible without the help of Dr. Richard Kiley, Dr. Rob Burlidge, and of course, President Skorton.
This series is the first of its kind as it unites the perspectives and interests of over 12 undergraduate health organizations. Under the umbrella of the Cornell Undergraduate Health Cooperative, also started this semester, we hope to present the Sick in America series as a holistic overview of the problems facing the healthcare system in America, as well as the potential solutions. And now, to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Garson, please give a warm round of applause for President Skorton.
Can you join me in thanking Nishant and Nikki and all the students who made this possible? It's really a terrific thing. And if you have a chance to look at this brochure, you'll see all the things that these group of student groups, the group of groups, has brought together. And it also links together the two campuses in a way that, you know, has been a very high priority of ours for a couple of years. And you'll notice that next week, on the 30th of April, there's an event in New York City, Business and Medicine Symposium, that's going to be simulcast in Sage Hall in B10. So I hope everybody will have a chance not only to enjoy tonight, which I'm sure you will, but also to enjoy the rest of the series. And again, Nishant and Nikki, thank you for making this possible. Very exciting. Tonight's lecture, as Nishant and Nikki mentioned, is also the kickoff for a new series of lectures, which we're going to sponsor out of my office, to bring faculty to the university to talk about current affairs. And the reason we're going to do that is really twofold. The first reason is that even in this time of financial duress, where you hear so much at this university and that other universities like it, about all the things that we cannot do right now, we have to remember that one of the things that we can do is to continue to support the intellectual ferment of a university and to, where it's appropriate, talk about things relevant to the world beyond the campus walls. And so the first purpose of doing this series is to do that, is to look forward and to look up, to cast our eyes up, and to do it in an area that's relevant to the world around us. And we're going to start tonight, as I'll tell you in just a moment, in one of the areas of greatest concern to virtually all facets of American society, from the business society to all of us as individuals, to a place like Cornell as an employer. The second reason for starting this new presidential lecture series is that I believe very strongly that the land-grant universities like Cornell have, as part of their public mission, work that we can do to help the country and the state and the region dig itself out from the dilemma that we're in. And once again, one of the things that's contributing very substantially to that dilemma is the dilemma that we have in healthcare delivery, and public health in general. So for those two reasons, it's a thrill that the students who set this up allowed me to dovetail the first of these presidential lectures on current affairs with this. So I thank you very much for your graciousness. I also want to announce, for those of you who think even this part of the thing is already too long and you're thinking, do I really have to stay for this, that we're going to have dessert. And it's been the students who understand all these kind of things, you know, very well, know that they have to do this in a very strategic way. So rather than bringing the food in right now so you could eat, get your fill, and leave, they have the dessert coming at the end of Dr. Garson's presentation. So you'll have this very tough internal dilemma where you'll have to decide, is it more important to sit through this, no matter how painful, and have dessert, or give them both up? And I can see it in your eyes that you're already conflicted about it. So now let me convince you that it's worth staying, even if we didn't have dessert. It's a great pleasure, a professional and a personal pleasure, to introduce an old friend of mine, and that doesn't mean that he's old, just that we've known each other for a long time, a colleague in pediatric cardiology and in broader aspects of academia, Arthur Garson Jr. He goes by Tim. And he's a very eclectic, open person. He's told me tonight that you can refer to him as Your Eminence. You don't have to call him Dr. Garson. Tim Garson is one of the country's very, very prominent pediatric cardiologists and had a hugely distinguished career as probably the most honored living practitioner of pediatric cardiology as it relates to the electrical activity of the heart. Literally wrote the book, a huge three-volume tome that was and is the Bible, the last word on pediatric electrophysiology. He was president of the American College of Cardiology and hugely known literally throughout the world. Somewhere along the trail of pursuing this very distinguished career, Tim Garson began to see beyond the confines of the examining room where he was working, of the classroom where he was teaching, and of the university hospital or medical school that he was helping to lead. And he saw the importance of thinking more broadly about public health, about healthcare delivery, and about the larger issues that not only affect that interaction between doctor and patient, but affect so many things in our country. Went back and got further training and another degree, and then reinvented himself as one of the country's leaders in an aspect of public health. This is very important for two reasons, not only having to do with his bona fides for sharing his ideas with us tonight, but to the students, a few of whom I was talking with just a few minutes ago about this, to imagine your career not only as you might see it through the lens of today as a freshman, sophomore, junior, senior about to go out into the world, but through the lens of thinking that you've learned skills that will allow you to adapt to your changing interests and to the changing needs of the world. And it would be hard to imagine someone who has followed that siren call of change and need better than Tim Garson. Tim graduated Phi Beta Kappa and summa cum laude from Princeton. He went on to earn his MD from Duke University, where he also did his residency in pediatrics. He completed his pediatric cardiology fellowship at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, one of the very finest in this area, and then got his MPH from the University of Texas in Houston. Before moving to the University of Virginia in 2002 as vice president and dean of the School of Medicine, he had high-level posts at several other institutions, including Duke, Baylor, and the Texas Children's Hospital. In addition to his leadership in medical education and as a clinician, he has been deeply involved in health policy. Tim served on the White House panel on health policy and chaired the National Advisory Council of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. He chaired the Healthcare Program Subcommittee of Virginia's Blue Ribbon Commission on Health Insurance and the Uninsured, and served on the Governor of Virginia's Health Reform Commission. He's also been a member of the Institute of Medicine Task Force on Rapid Improvements in the Healthcare System, the Commonwealth Fund Task Force on Health Insurance and the Uninsured, and chaired the American College of Cardiology's Task Force on the Uninsured. At UVA, Tim Garson teaches the introductory health policy course, Myths and Realities of American Healthcare, and his book, Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths, Not Enough Reality, was published in 2007 to great critical acclaim. His topic tonight is Healthcare Myths and Truths. Please join me in welcoming the kickoff speaker of this event and the kickoff speaker of the Presidential Lecture Series, Dr. Tim Garson.
It's hard to, this is one of those great times where those of you whose parents might hear something like that, this is the time when you'd say, my father would thank you and my mother would believe you. So thank you, President Skorton. We go back a long way. There's actually part of the story that makes sense, and he may not know it, and it's probably worth sharing with you before we get started, because I'm about to put you guys to work. This is a you talk to each other and a little bit to me, not me talk to you. So if you're getting ready to think about dessert versus this, you might want to be thinking about that. I won't call on anybody that doesn't raise their hand, though, so don't worry about that. The first night When I was a trainee in pediatric cardiology in Houston, I was taking care of a five-year-old girl who had been born a blue baby, and cardiologists in those days took care of all the post-op patients. Surgeons stayed in the operating room. We took care of them outside in the recovery room. She arrested 3 times that night, and each time she arrested, I went down the hallway and discussed what was going on with her parents and her grandparents. And the first time it was the roughest of, you know, this was their only little girl, and them saying to me, you know, we are trusting you to take care of her. Here I was, a first night trainee. Back and forth 3 times, art of medicine at one end of the hall, science of medicine at the other end of the hall, and needless to say, she made it through. We bonded, parents, grandparents, Ginny, me, and traded phone numbers when she finally went home. I went to her grammar school graduation. She lived about 80 miles from Houston. Went to her high school graduation, and at about 8:30 on a Sunday morning, about halfway into her 19th year, phone rings, and her mother is hysterical, and she's found her daughter dead in bed. And as we pieced the likely events back together, what it looks like happened is her Medicaid, her public funding, ran out at the age of 19, and she quit taking her medicine that was a drug that was absolutely keeping her alive, and never refilled a prescription after the time that her Medicaid ran out. So if you say, why would a sort of, you know, self-assuming pediatric cardiologist get into the uninsured and get into public health? It's a very simple one-person story. But when you hear numbers like 50 million, and we'll get there awfully soon if we're not there now, 50 million uninsured, just think about these people are one at a time. These are not 50 million. This is not the population of Australia. This is 50 million individuals. So that got my attention, and that's a little bit the direction that I went, and hopefully over the next several years we'll make some progress. Now, what I heard very quietly is that really you had invited Michael Moore. And I am delighted that you did. And I thought that instead of just showing up and being me, I'd show up as Michael Moore. Now, if anybody's got real thick glasses, and I'm told the good news is I need a little bit of a pillow, but I'm happy to at least try to fill in for him in a way that I'm sure that others could do as good or better a job, but I'll try, I promise. Now, we're going to do this. We're going to work together here, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to sort of come up with a statement, and you're going to take a vote about whether something is true or something is false, and then we're going to talk about it, okay? Now, Nikki and Nishant helped me to figure out some of the things that might be the most interesting. Perhaps I added one back in that might be a little bit controversial. But let's start with the following. American medical care is second rate compared to other developed countries. Now, you got to vote, okay? I'm going to keep track or you don't get dessert. So how many true American medical care is second rate compared to other countries? Way up. Okay, how many false? All right, not bad. Now, here comes another one. Take that hat off, Garson, right, okay. Now here comes, okay, Lindsay, take that hat off, right, here we go. American healthcare is second rate compared to other developed countries. How many true? How many false? And the rest of you are either too hungry to raise your hands or we're not so sure. Okay, Who would like to talk about the difference between medical care and health care? What's medical care? Somebody, what's medical care? Go. Okay, let me ask this. Let me ask a fact question. Do we need to be getting microphones to people? They can hear? Okay, great. All right. Awful good. Hold that thought. More. What's medical care?
Healthcare is the system, medical care is the treatment.
Okay, healthcare is the system, medical care is the treatment. All right, more. Yes, sir.
Medical care treats the disease or the condition, or healthcare treats the entire person.
Okay. One more. Ah, come on. Who said medical care is terrific? Who? One more time. Medical care is not second rate. Okay. Medical care is not second rate. So why not? Okay. Okay, so a medical care index, you want me to come back here, right? A medical care index is like breast cancer mortality. That's a medical care index. Right? It's what doctors and patients and nurses and other care providers do together. Breast cancer mortality. Now, the life expectancy in Harlem, in New York City, is lower than the life expectancy in Bangladesh. That's true. That's published. The infant mortality in Southeast Washington, D.C., is worse than the infant mortality in Nairobi, Kenya. So both of those are true. Healthcare indices, the major two healthcare indices are life expectancy and infant mortality. So now that we talk, now what does that mean? Tell me a little bit more. Does that help you to sort of say, okay, I get it. This is what healthcare is. What's healthcare? Weill Cornell, come on. Golly. Why would you want to go to the Mayo Clinic when you got Weill Cornell? Go ahead. Okay.
Where you're examining it. And if you raise your hand and say health system stinks, well, is it as a whole? I mean, if you have all the great technology and we've got this super technology in the United States, then you say, well, it's first rate, but for whom?
There you go. So what infant, here's the sort of take it one step further of life expectancy. In the United States, life expectancy is 40% lifestyle, 30% genetics, 20% public health, 10% medical care. One more time. 40% lifestyle, 30% genetics, 20% public health, 10% medical care. Now, that makes a guy like me go, wow, only 10% of life expectancy is actually due to the stuff that docs and patients and nurses and other... Yeah, because think about what's going on with obesity right now. Think about what's going on with smoking. Drugs, right? Think about Harlem. Harlem is not medical care. Harlem is drugs, obesity, smoking, murders, that's all life expectancy. That's healthcare. Okay? Infant mortality, very complicated. I suspect the infant mortality is going to be, we're a long way from understanding infant mortality. Life expectancy, you can at least identify something. There are people that talk about infant mortality being higher in poverty, higher in alcohol, higher in smoking, higher in African Americans. That's very complicated. My guess is we're going to learn a lot better over the next 10 years about really what, and infant mortality is basically premature babies, little tiny babies. So there's a lot to learn there that probably will turn out to be something we understand and can help, therefore more likely to be medical care than social. But these are complex interactions, as you're talking about who gets it. The uninsured, 20% higher mortality between the ages of 19 and 64, 20% higher. So when you say, well, are those related, is medical care and health care related? If you can't get to medical care, you die, and you die sooner. The uninsured get about half the medical care they need. And so life expectancy among the uninsured, worse than life expectancy among the insured. So it's related. So far, so good? All right. Questions? Okay, this is about you guys. Not when you can you have dessert? Not ready yet. Questions about that? Yes, sir. Nice tie. Absolutely right. I mean, I'll give you one, and I'll get it mainly right, because I just read this and haven't written it down. But there is a statistic, and again, these things are also correlative rather than causative, but the life expectancy, if you don't have a high school... Can you take your cell phone out of your pocket? Nah. I may have to answer it. He may be calling me. Put it over here.
Anywhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And you'll give it back to me next week when I forget it. There you go. The life expectancy of people with less than a high school education is hurt worse than the life expectancy diminution from having diabetes. So there are, and that, you know, when you say, well, that the lack of a high school education doesn't cause you to die, no. But the lack of a high school education certainly likely doesn't get you health insurance. And so these things get very, very correlative. So even obesity, diabetes, obesity causing diabetes, there are plenty of articles now that are talking about if we don't start to fix where obesity is going over the next 5 years, our life expectancy is going to go down in the whole United States for the first time since the Civil War. And it's going to be due to diabetes and heart disease and kidney disease and those things that diabetes causes. So it's complicated. When you then go look at other countries and you say their health care indices are better, so are their prison systems, so the sociologic issue, they've got less people in prison. They, ounce for ounce, have less people doing drugs. And so this whole notion of the social determinants of health, really important. A lot of really good work going on here in that area. So congratulations, a lot of good work going on here in that area. Okay, another one. We waste half of our healthcare dollars. We waste.
Pretty close.
Pretty close, he says. Okay, how many true? We waste half of our healthcare. How many false? A few more truths. All right. The number is around a third, close to a half. And you sort of go, where did that come from? All right, talk to me. If I'm going to tell you we waste the number this year for the U.S. healthcare system, even though the vast majority of that number, they call it national health expenditures, they really mean national medical expenditures. Okay, $2.4 trillion with a T. $800 billion a year wasted. Uh-oh. Where's it come from? Yes, sir. Talk some more. Terrific. You got there quick. Go. You're right. Complicated? Uh-huh. A little more. Keep talking. Okay, so let's hear a little. We're going to say administrative costs. What are the components of administrative costs? We waste a lot of money, and we do. Yeah.
Marketing.
There you go.
Pharmaceuticals.
Right. More. What do we waste money on? Yes, sir. Sounds like sicko.
Tiny little room with one computer. And I think that says a lot.
So on average in a physician's office, hold that thought, on average in a physician's office, not in big hospitals, but in a physician's office, there are 2 billing people per 1 doctor. Okay, so you got 12 docs, you got 24 billing people. Now, there is a very well-known and fun, neat health economist named Uwe Reinhardt, who's at Princeton. And Uwe gave a talk at the College of Cardiology a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things he said was, you're right to cut out all the waste, just not this year, please, because all of a sudden that means jobs. And it does. Now, this is an important point as you start to think about, we'll get there at the end. I've got 3 hours left, right, President? Yeah, good, okay.
3.5.
There you go, okay. As we start to think about, and we'll get back to the end, about what do you all think is going to happen in the next 6 to 12 months, one of the things that people are talking about is where's the money, can you save it, and can you really get the money out? The issue, this is obviously an unusual time to be saying, okay, we can save a lot of money, but remember, in the whole healthcare system, and $2.4 trillion is a lot, somebody is going to lose a job if we save money. That's generally a lot of those things we're about to talk about mean that somebody is going to make less money, including doctors, so we'll talk about that in a minute. More administrative costs. So now we've got marketing. More. What else? Yeah. Sir, go ahead.
The lack of a uniform and simple reimbursement structure.
We're complicated. Yeah. Right. You're right. That's tough to quantitate what that means. We can get to administrative. We can get to sort of, we know Medicare has about a 3% administrative cost. We know that the private sector has around a 25% administrative cost. That's got a lot of stuff in it, right? That's got inefficiencies, profit. And you know, the fun thing about the United States is we live here. You don't want to all of a sudden say, oh, okay, we're not going to have profit. So that's a really interesting sort of set of issues. Someone talked about the pharmaceutical companies. So where does that work? Or, you know, do you need the top 5 pharmaceutical companies to be in the Fortune 50? That's a choice America can make or not make. So we are in a for-profit society. Doctors make money. Hospitals make money. Lawyers make money. And so while we have a lot of not-for-profit hospitals, medical schools, those still have to, while they're not turning money around for shareholders, they clearly have to take money in to put it on the bottom line to buy capital equipment. So it is not perfectly, you know, it isn't just let's stop doing a number of things. What we clearly want to stop doing is having paper billing. We'll figure out how to train those people to do something else. We certainly don't want to do that. And you will hear a lot about electronic medical records over the next several years. The stimulus funding did a really interesting thing. The stimulus funding that came out set up new rules where doctors for the next 4 years are going to get paid extra to put electronic medical records into their practice. And in the fifth year, after 2014, they're going to get penalized. Now, that's fascinating. And physician behavior generally, give me 1%, maybe I'll pay attention to it. Cut me an eighth of a quarter of a tenth of a percent, I'm out of here. So docs do not like to see payment go down. And so Medicare, I think they've done a very smart thing. If you really want to get docs to pay attention, after the fourth year, payment goes down. So watch for the next 2 years, a little bit of sleepiness on the part of docs. At some point, beginning in around three, four, certainly the fifth year, you will see a bunch of physician practices. Now, what does that mean? That means you walk into the doc's office. They don't ask you for the fifth time where you live, what your date of birth was. They know who you are. They know what your allergies are. They ask you to update them. There's a computer sitting there. And in the best of all worlds, this isn't just about record keeping. This is about providing advice to doctors, nurses, and other caretakers about what to do in complicated patients. So this is not just let's, you know, call something up in the middle of the night and look at the x-ray. This is advice on how better to take care of patients. The words cookbook has been used over and over again, but like 20 years ago, cookbook medicine means there are guidelines. Gotta have a cookbook these days because medicine has gotten very, very complicated and there are guidelines. There are ways in which docs say, okay, this is the preferred way to practice. Well, you wanna put those into an electronic medical record. So, sir. There you go. So, administrative waste. What else?
Defensive medicine.
Okay.
A tendency for physicians nowadays to, do overtesting in order to prevent the occurrence of malpractice lawsuits and any negative consequences that occur.
Absolutely true. So, malpractice. Fears of getting sued. I'll tell you a story in a minute about a program. We'll talk about access in a minute. But interestingly, in China, a month ago when I was there talking about starting a new program, they asked about malpractice. They said, well, you're going to put new kinds of healthcare workers in, and we're worried about them getting sued. So even in China. So malpractice, big deal. It is, and we go on forever, and I'm standing between you and dessert. It is very difficult to tell whether someone is practicing defensive medicine without asking them. You cannot, and we tried this about 15 years ago before the Office of Technology Assessment went away. About 10 of us spent a weekend trying to say, can you look at a patient's chart and tell whether the doctor ordered a test because she or he was worried about getting sued? And the answer is no. So you have to ask them. You have to ask about motivation. You have to say, okay, here are a bunch of hypothetical reasons, and they can come up and give doctors, 10 different cases and say, what would you do here and why? But you have to rely on the doctor saying, I would do it because I was worried about getting sued. Please know that behaviorally in the same direction is doing more to make money, doing more because I am curious about the outcome, not badly curious, just, you know, I really am uncertain, I want to know. Same direction for doing the right thing. And so, unfortunately, there are a lot of competing things that when people do a lot, you then have to go ask them. And it is a lot easier. There is one study that I just pulled out again last week. It is a lot easier for a doctor to say, I'm going to do it because I'm going to get sued, than to say, I have this new machine, and this happens. I have this new machine. I'm in private practice. The person, the salesperson that sold me the machine said I have to do 14 of these per week in order to figure out how to pay this back with the depreciation. They do that. It is impossible that that doesn't enter into people's thinking. So it's complicated. Let me tell you that, yes, financial stimulus does have something to do with doctors doing stuff. We think about Canada as being sort of the land of, single payers, non-US. When they first put in the Canadian healthcare system in the 1950s, what they did was they froze prices. And the next year, that's all they did. They just froze prices. And the next year, the volume went up 6%. Trust me, Canadians did not get 6% sicker. Okay, so in fact, physicians in different parts of the world, certainly in this hemisphere, do, and they don't think about it most of the time, but in fact, the stimuli to do things are not as clear that we're going to do this because I'm going to get sued, I'm going to do this because I've got to pay this machine back, I'm going to do this because I'm not sure about the outcome of the patient. Complicated but true. Okay, what else? Waste. What else? How are we wasting money?
CEO salaries.
CEO salaries. Provost salaries. Oh.
One's getting $19 million a year.
First of all, yes, all right, that falls into overhead, and it's, again, yes, it's a little hard to know baseball players' salaries, CEOs' salaries. It's a little hard to know where to draw that line. But yes, there is. The guy that finished being the CEO of United Healthcare 4 years ago, I was having dinner with, and after not much on my side and a lot of red wine on his side, talked about his $500 million in stock options that he left with. So there's real money there. Okay, what else do we waste? Yeah. So inappropriate care or inappropriate billing? A little more. Is that right? Okay, here's the big one, all right? So there's administrative waste, there's profits, there's malpractice. There is, across the United States, between a 4 and 10 times variation in the intensity of what doctors do in different parts of the country. The rate of coronary bypass surgery in Miami, Florida is 4 times per 100,000 the rate in Salem, Oregon for the same sick patient. Same results 3 years later. Back surgery is 10 times, right? Spinal fusion, 10 times the variation. Same result 3 years later. Therefore, the presumption is, if you have the same result and you do more, you didn't need to do it. That number, here's statistic, if you think about U.S. medical care spending, year in, year out, it's between 3 and 3.5% higher than general inflation. So many years, it's twice as high, right? So general inflation is 3%. Medical inflation on top of it is 3%, so it's 6%. If you take the, come back to you in a minute, if you take the national average of 3.5% and you practice the way medicine is practiced in San Francisco, not in Boise, Idaho, in San Francisco, that's 2.4%. So the raise, the rate of rise in San Francisco is slower than the average in the country, $100 billion a year. $100 billion a year because doctors are overdoing stuff for all the reasons we just talked about. But docs are overdoing stuff. Yes, sir. Great question. Everyone, and are you saying, are there any? I'm not aware of really, and I'm sure somebody will say, what about? Okay, but in general, prostatectomy for prostate cancer or prostate hypertrophy. Hysterectomy for fibroids. Cancer seems to be a little bit more standardized, but still then, the rate of mastectomy very different in different parts of the country. Now, why is a really interesting question, but it will be very interesting what is being said in Washington is they are going to pay doctors differently in the next 5 years, and they're going to quit paying doctors as much on everything you do, you get paid for. That's called fee for service. And they're talking about really complicated things of bundling services where if you have a heart attack, you get paid a certain amount, you're done. So we'll see the extent to which, if doctors are not paid fee for service, that changes, in fact, the difference from one part to the other. Yeah. Yes. Perfect. Yes. It is a combination of patient-induced demand and doctor-induced demand, and they're both correct, right? We've got to fix both. The program, and I'll go very quickly through this. What's the difference between access and coverage? Who knows the difference between access and coverage?
Which, that's
there you go. Well, okay. So access, a little more. You're about there. What's coverage? When people say, yeah, people say you've got coverage, what's that mean?
So,
other than wearing a coat because it's cold.
So, insurance.
Okay, coverage, there you go. Coverage very simply means somebody else is paying the bill. No, that's too simple. No, it's not, because even if people have if they are self-insured and they get real sick, somebody else is paying the rest of that bill. So even if you're self-insured, if you have insurance, either private or the government is paying for you, Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, State Children's Health Insurance Program, county hospitals, all kinds of stuff, that's coverage. Access means you can get to the right person at the right time. It has nothing to do with coverage. So who can think of a time or a situation where a patient has 100% access and no coverage?
You might say Medicaid.
Hmm?
You might say Medicaid.
Medicaid is, but what happens? Okay, so they've got Medicaid, and that's coverage and no access. So are there parts of New York State with coverage and no access? So that's right. So that's
coverage goes, if the doctor will take it, it's pretty good.
So that's coverage and no access.
And it's access.
Well, or no access if they don't.
If the doctors would get the hell out of their system.
Uh-oh.
Then they would have access. All right?
Okay, what's the classic lots of access, no coverage? Go ahead. But that's, well, not in a lot of hospitals can you get somebody to do that without guaranteed payment. Okay, emergency rooms, now called emergency departments, right? Anybody can walk in off the street and get care in an emergency department. Access, 100% access, no coverage. We have a federal law that guarantees people who go into emergency departments and can get care. Now, you'll remember the last president talked about that being enough. You know, we don't have a problem, he said, because people can always go to the emergency department. Can you get your diabetes medicine? No. Can you get your preventive care? No. Can you get your mammogram? No. Can you get your follow-up care after your heart attack? A little. So no, right? Emergency departments are not where you take care of people in the long run. So no coverage, initial access. The flip side of no access, plenty of coverage, I assume there are parts of New York State like that where you just can't get to somebody. We certainly have that in Southwest Virginia, out in the coal fields west of Detroit. Virginia goes a long way out there. And they can be 4 or 5 hours from a dock. So one thing, and this is just a little bit of fun, and I told President Scorton I'd tell you about it real quick, is the notion of providing access by having a core of grandparents, this is real, okay, a core of people who have taken care of two generations of their children and their children's children to work in their own communities to provide care that a good grandparent could take care of. So colds, sore throats, vomiting, diarrhea, sprained ankles, stuff that a good grandparent could do in their own underserved area. They get trained, they get given a mini computer. The mini computer has protocols in it. The protocols have electronic medical records associated with them. The mini computer has a telephone, has Skype telephone, has video, so they can get back to a nurse in the middle of the night if they need to, and we pay them $20,000 a year. So that's being tested in Virginia, Mississippi, Houston, Shanghai, Beijing, Inner Mongolia, and Lesotho, Africa. That's access. And trust me, as we get further, I hope, and I'm not sure, and I hope there are those of you in the room that are sure, I'm not, about what's going to happen in the next year with Washington, but we will, if everybody has an insurance card, we will still have a problem with access. We will still not be able to provide appropriate care to numbers of people. The number in Massachusetts, 400,000 people, after they got coverage, were found to have trouble getting access to a primary care doc. Well, guess what? Maybe they don't need to see a primary care doc as often as they think they do. So we'll see. That's the difference between coverage and access. Okay, are you ready to get your teeth ground? Because this one always gets people. Preventive care saves money. How many true? How many false?
Preventive care saves
money.
I would say it.
There you go. False? False? Okay, go. False.
I would say maybe it helps their health, but not money. So it might cost more to prevent an illness than it would cure it after it comes on, but it would probably give you a better outcome if you start early.
I think I read a recent article on this. I don't remember
if you sure did. Okay, who else said no? Who said yes? This is one of the great half truths. So it's both.
I said yes.
Because? Got an example?
I think that there's a lot of studies that show that generally speaking, you know, preventing things like long term smoking from obesity, I mean basically preventing chronic diseases does save money.
Okay, so here's this is why people, okay, let me, if I say it three times, we'll remember it. Preventive care is the right thing to do. Yes, please, right? It's the right thing to do. It saves people's lives. It keeps them alive well longer for, you know, terrific. But in the macro sense, it does not save money. Here are two examples. A study from Holland last year. Total health care costs after the age of 20, looked at their entire population. Smokers die at 77 and save $100,000 in medical care costs compared to non-smokers who die at 83. Obese people die at 80 and save $50,000 in care costs compared to non-obese people who die at 83. Just came out last week, a study in Arizona where they started, and they would not, what they said was smokers in, and this is going to be really interesting if anybody picks it up, Medicare, the data are that smokers die 10 years earlier than non-smokers. Now, they said, this is US, the heck with Holland. They did not say what the savings were, but they said their savings. Now, you will remember the cigarette companies paid Medicaid. Now, that's going to be real interesting if, in fact, the cigarette companies should be paid by Medicaid. So, I'm not advocating. Please don't, you know, let's come back to what I'd like you to remember, right? Preventive care is the right thing. Personal story, I've had two parents die of lung cancer. No, thank you. You do not want to die that way. So smoking is horrible. Okay, being overweight, if you're morbidly obese, there is a 28% reduction in the amount of work you do from day to day. This isn't just medical care costs. Okay, so prevention's the right thing. The study that came out last February 14th, 2008 in the New England Journal of Medicine, some very good people, including a Nobel Prize winner, looked at whether preventive care saves money or does not, and 81% of preventive care costs money, 19% saves money. And they looked at a bunch, 160 or something things.
Which were the ones that saved?
Oh, measles vaccination. Okay, measles vaccination, not all vaccinations, but measles vaccination is the one that people talk about, because what happens with measles is you don't die. You get something called encephalitis. I gotta be real careful. I wrote an op-ed in USA Today right after this thing came out, and I said, you don't die from measles, and some pediatrician literally called up the editor of USA Today and said, of course you die from measles. Well, yes, you do, but one case in the last 7 years in the United States. So they printed a retraction. So in general, you do not die from measles. In general, if you get something awful, it's encephalitis. Encephalitis is a long-term care problem, and you do not die from it. And so it is very expensive. So the reason, or a reason, that measles vaccination saves money is if you don't vaccinate people, a certain percentage of them are going to get encephalitis. Some of the asthma preventive care that's coming out now saves money because you don't die in one way or the other. And so it saves money in terms of emergency room visits. Some of those things are out there. But a lot of the things that we would like to think of, why? Because you apply preventive care to a lot of people who don't need it. Okay? So that's one of the reasons. As we get better at determining who needs to take statins, right now all we know is that you have a certain cholesterol and therefore there is an association of a high cholesterol with heart and vascular disease, so everybody with that cholesterol. Well, it can't possibly mean that everybody with that cholesterol needs it. But until we get better at genetic testing, protein testing, everybody's going to get it. Okay, so good thing, right thing to do. Let me end this with my father's statement when he was 83. And he said, you know, in aging, what you really want to do is have early old age last as long as possible and late old age last 15 minutes. Now, if we can make that happen, then preventive care saves money. Okay, if I've got it right, literally we got 5-6 minutes before the food shows up. Is that right, folks? Okay. Let's finish, and I think you know this one. There is a federal safety net for the uninsured, federal safety net for the uninsured who have no money. How many true? How many false? How many are too tired to care?
Repeat the statement.
Federal safety net, federal program, if you have no money, that will provide medical care for you if you're uninsured. How many true? How many false? Here's the answer, okay? Between the ages, Ginny, between the ages of 19 and 64, unless you are blind, disabled, have kidney disease, or pregnant, or all four at the same time, or any combination, you are not covered by federal statute. Now, states can vary that, but by federal statute, New York State has changed that. By federal statute, there is no safety net for the uninsured between the ages of 19 and 64. That's why we've got, and I suspect you will hear that number, 50 million uninsured, awfully quickly. We had 46 and we had 45 last year. The odds are pretty good, and I was talking to you've got some very good people here. This is had a fun day. Thank you, President Gorton. The question of whether if you lose your job in this time period over the last 6 months, did those people were they more likely to have health insurance than people that lost their jobs 3 years ago? Probably not, but I'll bet you we get to 50 million uninsured. Just so you're clear, that's more than the population of Canada and Australia. It's a lot of people. So the notion, real quick, the notion of what's going to happen, right? The last chapter of the book says, we'll never see substantive change around here. And we think, Carolyn and I, who we had brains and brawn, I wrote the book in 5 weeks, and then Carolyn made it right. So that was the important part. The last chapter says, you know, nothing going to happen. There's nothing we can do. And we think that's a myth. We got some stars that we thought were aligned, and then we have a budget issue. My suspicion is we will have legislation. I mean, you'll see it. And it'll probably 2 bills in the Senate, 1 bill in the House. And it should come down to policy for the United States saying this is absurd that we have anybody who doesn't have coverage. Now, access is another issue, as we've heard. I don't think there is yet the anger in the United States quite yet to carry the day. So I'm hoping, right, because what it's sort of, I don't want to take it anymore, and I think there's a lot out there right now. It was coming, a lot out there with the economy, and we'll just have to see. But it is going to take the American public saying this is awful. It's not about 50 million uninsured saying it. It's about the rest of us saying it. And given all the other pressures going on right now, I wish it were different, but it may not be. So that the old biologic term, chemical term, the energy of activation, what's going to be required to get over that hump, I hope we get there, but stay tuned. We'll see. But the American public are going to have to want it. Nice people, President, thank you.